Dr. Ferris leaned toward Dr. Stadler. Through the staccato hoofbeats of the announcer's voice galloping across the continent with a description of the new invention, and said in the tone of a casual remark, "It is vitally important that there be no criticism of the project in the country at this precarious time." Then added semi-accidentally, as a semi-joke, "That there be no criticism of anything at any time." "And the nation's political, cultural, intellectual, and moral leaders," the announcer was yelling into the microphone, "who have witnessed this great event as your representatives and in your name, will now tell you their views of it in person." Mr. Thompson was the first to mount the wooden steps to the platform of the microphone. He snapped his way through a brief speech, hailing a new era and declaring, in the belligerent tone of a challenge to unidentified enemies, that science belonged to the people and that every man on the face of the globe had a right to a share of the advantages created by technological progress. Wesley Mooch came next. He spoke about social planning and the necessity of unanimous rallying in support of the planners. He spoke about discipline, unity, austerity, and the patriotic duty of bearing temporary hardships. "We have mobilized the best brains of the country to work for your welfare. This great invention was the product of the genius of a man whose devotion to the cause of humanity is not to be questioned, a man acknowledged by all as the greatest mind of the century, Dr. Robert Stadler." "What?" gasped Dr. Stadler, whirling toward Ferris. Dr. Ferris looked at him with a glance of patient mildness. "He didn't ask my permission to say that," Dr. Stadler half snapped, half whispered. Dr. Ferris spread out his hands in a gesture of reproachful helplessness. "Now you see, Dr. Stadler, how unfortunate it is if you allow yourself to be disturbed by political matters which you have always considered unworthy of your attention and knowledge. You see, it is not Mr. Mooch's function to ask permissions." The figure, now slouching against the sky on the speaker's platform, coiling itself about the microphone, talking in the bored, contemptuous tone of an off-color story, was Dr. Simon Pritchett. He was declaring that the new invention was an instrument of social welfare, which guaranteed general prosperity, and that anyone who doubted this self-evident fact was an enemy of society to be treated accordingly. "This invention, the product of Dr. Robert Stadler, the preeminent lover of freedom..." Dr. Ferris opened a briefcase, produced some pages of neatly typed copy, and turned to Dr. Stadler. "You are to be the climax of the broadcast," he said. "You will speak last at the end of the hour." He extended the pages. "Here's the speech you'll make." His eyes said the rest. They said that his choice of words had not been accidental. Dr. Stadler took the pages, but held them between the tips of two straight fingers, as one might hold a scrap of waste paper about to be tossed aside. "I haven't asked you to appoint yourself as my ghostwriter," he said. The sarcasm of the voice gave Ferris his clue. This was not a moment for sarcasm. "I couldn't have allowed your invaluable time to be taken up by the writing of radio speeches," said Dr. Ferris. "I felt certain that you would appreciate it." He said it in a tone of spurious politeness, intended to be recognized as spurious, the tone of tossing to a beggar the alms of face-saving. Dr. Stadler's answer disturbed him. Dr. Stadler did not choose to answer, or to glance down at the manuscript. "Lack of faith," a beefy speaker was snarling on the platform in the tone of a street brawl. "Lack of faith is the only thing we got to fear. If we have faith in the plans of our leaders, why, the plans will work, and we'll all have prosperity and ease and plenty. It's the fellows who go around doubting and destroying our morale. It's they're who keeping us in shortages and misery. But we're not going to let them do it much longer. We're here to protect the people. And if any of those doubting smarties come around, believe you me, we'll take care of them." "It would be unfortunate," said Dr. Ferris in a soft voice, "to arouse popular resentment against the State Science Institute at an explosive time like the present. There's a great deal of dissatisfaction and unrest in the country, and if people should misunderstand the nature of the new invention, they're liable to vent their rage on all scientists. Scientists have never been popular with the masses." "Peace," a tall, willowy woman was sighing into the microphone. "This invention is a great new instrument of peace. It will protect us from the aggressive designs of selfish enemies. It will allow us to breathe freely and to learn to love our fellow men." She had a bony face with a mouth embittered at cocktail parties, and wore a flowing pale blue gown, suggesting the concert garment of a harpist. It may well be considered as that miracle which was thought impossible in history, the dream of the ages, the final synthesis of science and love. Dr. Stadler looked at the faces in the grandstands. They were sitting quietly now, they were listening, but their eyes had an ebbing look of twilight, a look of fear in the process of being accepted as permanent, the look of raw wounds being dimmed by the veil of infection. They knew as he knew it, that they were the targets of the shapeless funnels protruding from the mushroom building's dome. And he wondered in what manner they were now extinguishing their minds and escaping that knowledge. He knew that the words they were eager to absorb and believe were the chains slipping in to hold them like the goats, securely within the range of those funnels. They were eager to believe. He saw the tightening lines of their lips. He saw the occasional glances of suspicion they threw at their neighbors, as if the horror that threatened them was not the sound ray, but the men who would make them acknowledge it as horror. Their eyes were veiling over, but the remnant look of a wound was a cry for help. "What do you think they think?" said Dr. Ferris softly. "Reason is the scientist's only weapon, and reason has no power over men, has it? At a time like ours, with the country falling apart, with the mob driven by blind desperation to the edge of open riots and violence, order must be maintained by any means available. What can we do when we have to deal with people?" Dr. Stadler did not answer. A fat, jellied woman with an inadequate brassiere under a dark, perspiration-stained dress was saying into the microphone, Dr. Stadler could not believe it at first, that the new invention was to be greeted with particular gratitude by the mothers of the country. Dr. Stadler turned away. Watching him, Ferris could see nothing but the noble line of the high forehead and the deep cut of bitterness at the corner of the mouth. Suddenly, without context or warning, Robert Stadler whirled to face him. It was like a spurt of blood from a sudden crack in a wound that had almost closed. Stadler's face was open. Open in pain, in horror, in sincerity. As if for that moment both he and Ferris were human beings, while he moaned with incredulous despair. "In a civilized century, Ferris. In a civilized century." Dr. Ferris took his time to produce and prolong a soft chuckle. "I don't know what you're talking about," he answered in the tone of a quotation. Dr. Stadler lowered his eyes. When Ferris spoke again, his voice had the faintest edge of a tone which Stadler could not define, except that it did not belong in any civilized discussion. "It would be unfortunate if anything were to happen to jeopardize the State Science Institute. It would be most unfortunate if the Institute were to be closed, or if any one of us were to be forced to leave it. Where would we go? Scientists are an inordinate luxury these days, and there aren't many people or establishments left who are able to afford necessities, let alone luxuries. There are no doors left open to us. We wouldn't be welcome in the research department of an industrial concern such as, let us say, Reardon Steel. Besides, if we should happen to make enemies, the same enemies would be feared by any person tempted to employ our talents. A man like Reardon would have fought for us. Would a man like Orrin Boyle? But this is purely theoretical speculation because, as a matter of practical fact, all private establishments of scientific research have been closed by law, by Directive 10-289, issued, as you might not realize, by Mr. Wesley Mooch. Are you thinking, perhaps, of universities? They are in the same position. They can't afford to make enemies. Who would speak up for us? I believe that some such man as Hugh Axton would have come to our defense. But to think of that is to be guilty of an anachronism. He belonged to a different age. The conditions set up in our social and economic reality have long since made his continued existence impossible. And I don't think that Dr. Simon Pritchett, or the generation reared under his guidance, would be able or willing to defend us. I have never believed in the efficacy of idealists. Have you? And this is no age for impractical idealism. If anyone wished to oppose a government policy, how would he make himself heard? Through these gentlemen of the press, Dr. Stadler? Through this microphone? Is there an independent newspaper left in the country, an uncontrolled radio station, a private piece of property for that matter, or a personal opinion? The tone of the voice was obvious now. It was the tone of a thug. A personal opinion is the one luxury that nobody can afford today.